A very exciting satellite session, an exciting session in an already very exciting conference. May I introduce you to you first, my co-chair, Mr. Jean-Paul Moaty. Professor Moaty is professor of economics at the University of Marseille, and he's chair of the Public Health Committee of the French Agency of AIDS Research, ANRS.
Good afternoon. It's also a pleasure to co-chair this session with Paul Beckers, who is the Director for Health, Gender and Civil Society in the Ministry of Development and Cooperation, and who is also Ambassador for HIV/AIDS for the Netherlands.
And we have a very highly interesting panel, and we'd like to introduce them to you. First of all, it is Minister Ramat Nabeng. She's the Minister of Health and Social Welfare of Lesotho. Prior to that, the minister was practicing a private practice. Also Minister of Health of Ethiopia, Minister Tedros Ghebreyesus is here. He is the Minister of Health of the Federal Democratic Republic of Ethiopia since October 2005. And Alvaro Bermejo we'd like to introduce. Alvaro is the Executive Director of the International HIV/AIDS Alliance since 2003. And prior to that, he was the Director of Health and Care Department of the International Federation of Red Cross and Red Crescent Societies.
In the panel, we also have Minister Bert Kunders, Ministry of Development and Cooperation from the Netherlands. We have Professor Michel Kazatchkin, who I know because he was the Director of the French Agency for AIDS Research, but now is the Executive Director of a Global Fund. We have Ambassador Mark Dibble, who everybody knows is the United States Global AIDS Coordinator leading the implementation of President Bush's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief. We have Mr. Malcolm McNeil, who is a team leader for the AIDS and Reproductive Health Team at DFID, the UK Cooperation Agency.
And they have three more panelists, Mrs. Joy Pumapi. She's the Vice President of the World Bank's Human Development Network. And before she joined the bank in 2007, she served as the Assistant Director General for Family and Community Health at the World Health Organization. Michelle Sidibe, I think everybody knows Michelle, Assistant Secretary General and Deputy Executive Director of UNAIDS since 2001. Michelle is from Mali and represented UNICEF in several African countries before that. And last but not least, we'd like to introduce, Mr. Hiroki Nakatani. He's Assistant Director General, HIV/AIDS, TB, Malaria, and Neglected Tropical Diseases at WHO. We have been standing, but that was just to get your attention. Now the two of us will remain seated when we start the further introductions to the subject.
Yes, as you see, we have a very high level and important people in this panel. And and maybe it's a reason why, as you may have noticed, it's the longest session in the whole conference, maybe the longest session ever in the history of International AIDS Conference. But let's be clear, Paul or myself are responsible for this. But I hope and I'm sure that you will stay in the room because all the members of our panel are going really to tackle major issues that are at the heart of the whole conference and that are debated not only in this panel but in the whole conference. The questions such as the issue of sustainability and long-term sustainability of financing, the relationship between the specific HIV programs and health system strengthening, which is at the heart of a lot of debates, not only at the conference, but worldwide. The way we can improve the use of increasing resources that are devoted to HIV, including the trade-off between prevention and treatment and other activities in resource allocations. And, of course, the question of harmonization of the programs, of the various relationship between the recipient countries and programs and the donor agency and the normative and technical agencies. So I'll leave the floor to Paul, that will give you an idea of how this session is going to be organized, because you are also part of a session through the questions that you will be able to ask to the members of the panel.
Continue on what Jean-Paul was saying, it is a lengthy session, so we kind of suggested to have it a little bit split up in five parts. First of all, we have an... Okay, we'll, sorry for the technical parts, but we're going to use this microphone from now on. As I was saying, it's a lengthy session. We'll suggest to split it up in five different sections. First of all, there will be an introduction by the Minister for Development Cooperation of the Netherlands, and then we'll have three separate sections on the issue of global financial architecture. We'll have a session on a perspective from recipient countries and implementers. After that, we focus on the points of view from the donors and financing mechanisms. And the last one will be the point of view from the normative agencies, WHO and UNAIDS. And each of the session will start with an introduction by each of the relevant panelists, then followed by a reaction of the other panelists. And that we want to make sure that you are very involved also, so the very last part will be an hour for you to raise your questions, because after listening to what for 1.5-2 hours, you are extremely keen and eager to raise certain questions and start a discussion with the panelists. For that, we would like to ask you to use the cards. There will be cards available. Please write down your question. Then will be collected by people that are present here. They will be collected, and we try to have all these questions answered. If you want to help us in that, to make the session really worthwhile, also logistically organized, we thank you for that.
Now we're going to start. As an economist, I've always been unhappy sometimes when I was working with in the health field, because I was only relating with health people, and I thought it was important to go broader, and especially it's important at this moment in the HIV, and that's why it's a special pleasure for me to give the floor to Minister Condors, who is Ministry of Development and Cooperation, so he's able to give us a broader framework, but at the same time he's very, very competent and knowledgeable on health issues and HIV AIDS issue, so he's really the perfect person to do the introduction. Minister Condors.
Honourable ministers, ladies and gentlemen, let me assure you that it is not going to be the longest speech ever held in any conference around the world. I just hope to stir some debate on one of the crucial questions that we are going to deal with in the next couple of years. And for me, as a Dutch Minister for Development Cooperation, this is a key moment probably of this conference. And I'm very, very pleased to have an opportunity to give my perspectives on the topic of this afternoon's discussion, which is the global financial architecture of the AIDS response. On all of this, we know that the proof of the pudding is in the eating. In 2006, global leaders made a commitment to achieve universal access, the great slogan of this conference, to HIV protection, treatment, care and support by 2010. This commitment represents an exciting, in my view, level of ambition and hope, but also poses formidable challenges to all of us. Each one of us represented in this panel, implementing country governments, donors, financing institutions, global normative agencies, you could probably say the whole aid industry, is grappling with very, very difficult questions that will be the topics of this afternoon's discussion. How can we really make sure that scaling up HIV services contributes to health system strengthening rather than detracting from it? How can we ensure that resources, domestic and international, are spent effectively? And this will ensure the support of our own citizens, our own voters, but especially also the support of those who suffer from HIV/AIDS. And how do we sustain funding for lifelong treatment when we know that resource needs will increase dramatically over the coming years? And how can we collectively better support national efforts to fight HIV/AIDS and limit the transaction costs to developing country governments who already have a great crisis in terms of food crisis, oil prices, and so on and so forth? These are the key questions we would like to discuss this afternoon. And I want to focus my intervention on two critical areas. First of all, I would like to speak about the level of funding and the way funds are used. And secondly, I will reflect on linkages between HIV/AIDS and the broader health and development issues. We're talking here of an issue of international global public health. Start by funding. Funding for HIV/AIDS has increased 20-fold over the last decade to an estimated $10 billion in 2007. That's unprecedented in international development, and we owe it, we really owe it to the unwavering efforts of so many advocates around the world and so many people that are present here today. But is it enough? That is going to be the key question, and we know that it's not nearly so. UNAIDS estimates that funding levels must quadruple between 2007 and 2010 to achieve universal access. We enormously welcome, and I would like to compliment the government of the United States and also the AIDS ambassador present here, to the fact that the United States has renewed its global AIDS program and to significantly increase the resources that will be made available. We would like to see similar resolve in other major economies of the world, and this is now, I think, essential. A recent study by UNAIDS and the Kaiser Foundation listed my country, the Netherlands, as the number one per capita donor on HIV/AIDS and the third international donor in absolute terms after the United States and the United Kingdom. Of course, I'm proud of this figure, but I'm not complacent. I have mixed feelings about being the third largest donor internationally. Should I consider this an achievement of a relatively small economy? Or is it rather a sign of underachievement of all those other countries with economies that are far larger than ours? I tend to the latter interpretation, and I think it's important to think about that political message. Are we spending our money then effectively? The latest UNAIDS report that was released last week contains some very encouraging news. There's a lot of positive news in this conference that I've always able to reflect also to my own citizens in my own country, that aid works, that it helps people, that it saves lives. 3 million people in low and middle income countries are now on treatment, and the number of deaths due to AIDS are slowly declining. More HIV-positive pregnant women receive antiretrovirals to prevent the transmission to children. Yes, HIV prevention efforts are beginning to show success in some countries, and we see encouraging signs of sexual behavior change among very many young people. These are very welcome indications that money can lead to results and that funding has produced impact. We can, and I think we must, however, do much more to increase our effectiveness. We must look harder to reach the people who do not have access to the treatment, in the distant places, the distant villages, the people who are forgotten. These are disproportionately the disadvantaged and marginalized groups in our societies. We must massively scale up prevention efforts and address the real drivers of the epidemic. It's prevention, prevention, and prevention, in my view, that needs a lot of attention. Know your epidemic should be the basis for evidence-based planning, with no room for ostrich tactics and denial. Power dynamics and the poor position of women and girls increase their vulnerability for infection. We know that. There are horror stories around. We must do much more to empower women and respect their sexual and reproductive health and rights. We must do much more to protect the rights of marginalized groups, such as injecting drugs users. Still, I think a much too forgotten issue, harm reduction, sex workers and sexual minorities, and increase their access to effective interventions. Last week's edition of Science contained a rather disturbing figure on prevention expenditures on men having sex with men. In Latin America, especially, countries with highly concentrated epidemics in this group. It's an important point. With some exceptions, Mexico and Peru in particular, the overall picture was grim and illustrates the overt bias against sexual minorities in many countries in the region. Then the question is, are we spending our money equitably? Last week's Science clearly demonstrates that we are not. Whilst a number of well-organized countries have been successful in securing significant commitments from donors, others have not. Rwanda has received over $2,000 per affected person, while this amount is lower than $150 for countries such as the Democratic Republic of Congo, Central African Republic, Sudan, and Myanmar. Now, let me assure you, my point is not that Rwanda gets too much money. They are doing a terrific job in working on AIDS prevention, on treatment, and so on. But it's clearly that we have to deal with this imbalance. Corrupt governments, civil wars, and the absence of infrastructure scare away donors, understandably so. And there are no simple solutions to this, and we know at the same time that any global response to AIDS must address the impact of epidemics in these fragile states. This is a collective responsibility and one where each and every one of us must be prepared to take the risk. Secondly, on this issue, I want to share some reflections on the need to improve the linkages between the AIDS response and the broader health and development agenda. It's evident that better integration is needed to achieve and to sustain universal access. We cannot reach it, the one without the other. We must combine the incredible energy and activism of the AIDS community with the long-term approaches to sustainable and equitable development. There's an enormous chance here. And in my view, for much too long, this debate has been polarized in a very unhelpful way. I also believe that the onus for integration has too often been put with the AIDS community, whereas the health and development community has a responsibility too. Integration requires all of us to move to a middle ground, and I'm convinced that there is so much that we can learn from each other. And maybe middle ground is not the right word. It's innovation, a better definition of what we actually mean in practice, on the ground, in specific countries, with what we call health systems. Over the last few years, there has been a particularly heated ideological debate on this, and speeches during the opening session and during yesterday's meeting indicated that there is now a greater openness in the AIDS community to have these discussions. We know that there are real issues in some countries. Let's be openly discuss them. Tanzania pointed to the distortive effects of targeted HIV funding on health systems. But there is also a growing body of evidence of countries that have managed to use targeted funding to achieve disease-specific outcomes and broader systems benefits at the same time by investing in key areas such as human resources and infrastructure. And I think what President Clinton yesterday said on this was extremely useful. He made this debate extremely pragmatic and innovative. Rwanda and Ethiopia are countries that come to mind. We should learn from these experiences and work towards pragmatic solutions. We simply cannot afford competing over scarce resources. The sad reality is that health systems have been underfunded for decades, and HIV is certainly a long way of being considered overfunded. We must demystify what we mean by health systems and clarify what needs to be done to meet people's needs and legitimate expectation when it comes to healthcare. People, that's what counts. We have to start from the definition of what people need. And primary healthcare might be a good binding framework to integrate these different elements. In any case, in my view, solutions will need to be country-specific. As international agencies, donors, multilateral agencies, and financing institutions, we have a moral obligation to support countries in these efforts, and I would be interested to hear from our panelists how they see their role in this regard. Now, apart from funding, the AIDS response has introduced important paradigm shifts that are of great relevance to the health sector and development more broadly. One important shift is the notion that access to care and treatment is a right, not a charity. Another one is the recognition of the crucial role of civil society organizations as advocates, as watchdogs, and as service providers. If we manage to integrate this thinking into our own approaches to health system strengthening, we can make a giant leap towards the development of responsive health systems that deliver results that matter to people. Sustaining universal access over the long term requires better integration of HIV/AIDS in the broader development agenda. That's the message. Unfortunately, these obvious linkages are very often very poorly developed. In many cases, the AIDS response happens quite in parallel from broader development efforts. In too many countries, HIV/AIDS is still not well integrated into poverty reduction strategies or medium-term expenditure frameworks. Moreover, these instruments are rather exclusively focused only on the public sector. One could say that many of the traditional aid instruments are not sufficiently AIDS-proof, and that's what we have to accomplish, AIDS-proof instruments. And this can have huge implications, even more so as many bilateral donors are moving towards upstream funding modalities such as direct budget support. At the same time, most of the AIDS funding is delivered through different channels, such as PEPFAR, the Global Fund, or the World Bank MAP. I see a serious risk for an increasing and persistent disconnect between these two efforts. So whilst there is a compelling case for linkage, there is as yet little evidence on how that should be done. Again, this requires all of us to rethink the way we are doing our business. It requires the main AIDS funding agencies to improve their behavior as far as harmonization and alignment is concerned. But it also requires a much more thorough discussion on how HIV/AIDS and other cross-cutting issues, such as gender, sexual and reproductive rights, and other cross-cutting issues, are really part of our traditional AIDS instruments, and on the potential negative spillover of the implementation of the Paris Declaration in that respect, if important development issues are not adequately addressed in the tools that we use. Again, I'm very much looking forward to the debate on this. I mention these issues because I think they are the key for the debate in the upcoming years. And they can be based, our answers, on the enormous progress that we have made. We have a panel of highly distinguished speakers that represent different elements of the global architecture for HIV/AIDS. We have you as an audience that is brimming over, and I was very impressed with it as a first comer to these AIDS conferences, with energy, creativity and passion. And I'm very much looking forward to a lively debate between all of our participants. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Minister Kunders. I think you already raised a number of provocative questions to the panelists, so I immediately give the floor to Minister Ramat Lapeng from Ministry of Health and Social Welfare from Lesotho. Mrs. Minister.
Thank you, Chairman, and let me thank you for really including me in this illustrious panel, to be part of it and to be able to share with you our experience in Lesotho. I'm just a Minister of Health. I'm a medical doctor. I'm not an economist. And when I was asked to speak on this panel, I asked, what does global financial architecture mean? So I was advised that I could probably talk about challenges of current financial architecture for recipient countries and implementers. Lesotho is a small country, relatively small country, that is totally surrounded by one country in Southern Africa with a very high disease burden in HIV and AIDS. It has a prevalence of 23%, and for us, it is an emergency. But having said that, in comparison with other countries, Lesotho has not been able to attract a large number of development partners to come and assist it to work in this field of HIV and AIDS and TB. However, the few partners that are on the ground in Lesotho have each insisted on having their own project implementation unit, which manages their funds. And it is difficult for us to insist that donors comply and use existing structures of government because we would like to retain the few donors that we have. In other words, they come in, they do not strengthen the systems, existing systems, they instead introduce their own systems. For Lesotho, as I have mentioned, a small country, we have several project accounting units just in the Ministry of Health. And I know there are a few also in the Ministry of Education. And this poses a tremendous strain on us because we have parallel reporting requirements, and they put a lot of strain on our already a few human resources remaining in the Ministry of Health. You will realize, like other countries in the Southern Africa, I'm afraid the echo here is causing so much. Like a few countries in Southern Africa, we also have a number of our own health personnel who are living, and the attrition rate is indeed very high. As a result of these parallel reporting mechanisms and systems, we then have low absorption of funds within government systems owing to capacity constraints. Traditionally, most of our partners or donors have focused on supporting interventions at health delivery level without recognizing need for additional HR support at management and coordination level that will remain part of the system, and not just TAs or consultants that come in for 2 years and then leave. We recognize that we need structured space for dialogue between government and partners, and this is critical. Partners will clamor for individual time with senior government representatives, which results in a lot of meetings with little time left for actual driving the monitoring and implementation. Some donors then are very upset when we show lack of capacity or when implementation is very slow. There are significant challenges with coordination of large global funding initiatives such as PEPFAR and Global Fund, and you'll realize I'm sitting just between them. And that's why I was a little bit traumatized when they put me between the two of them. They have mobilized significant volumes of funding and significant progress is being made. However, there is a need to ensure a stronger focus on harmonization and alignment and systems development. Proper coordination of NGOs and other donors by government is needed to ensure better coverage for neglected areas when these NGOs are directed to work in geographically challenged locations. To achieve this, NGOs also need to be open and transparent to working with governments. Most of the time, NGOs are very reluctant to actually, or in fact, they are reluctant and they are not transparent when they are working with governments. In other words, we need a very strong government leadership to coordinate our donors when we are managing all these complex and overlapping donor expectations. In addition to government leadership, there is a need to include government to work within one sector plan to achieve predictability of resources by critical mass of like-minded donors, so that when we do have new donors, then all of them will just be channeled to work in the same system. Observing Paris Declaration recommendations and development, partners signing up to adherence and application of the principles of effectiveness in health and HIV policy and programming, both at country and global level, is very important. Health system strengthening is critical to long-term sustainability of results. We realize that the vertical disease-specific approach may in some cases deliver more rapid results, but issues of sustainability quickly arise. applying the same vertical or project type approach to systems aspects such as skills development and human resources could be beneficial, but there is a need to ensure that health system strengthening does not become projectized. Swaps or systems-wide approach, there seems to be an emerging understanding that well-established swaps can handle some vertical initiatives in such a way that they don't undermine systems and could be shaped to support system. Critical success factors include being on budget and on plan, even if financing cannot be pooled. And I realize that I've just mentioned the two organizations that will not agree to be pooled. A lot can be learned from the recent agreement by Global Fund to align its funding to health sector plan and processes in Mozambique. We have been to Mozambique, we are observing what they are doing there, and we are hopeful that we can learn something from it, and hopefully that can be applied to the entire Global Fund mechanisms all over the world. In order to be able to harmonize and coordinate all our activities, we need to have a common health partners coordination forum and working within a common agreed code of conduct. We have to expedite decentralization of services and systems. There is a need to work more strategically with ministries of finance to foster greater government ownership and control over donor funding that is in the health sector in all our countries. Also, there is a need to reduce the number of parallel funding mechanisms, especially in Lesotho, where there is a significant number of project accounting units, as I've already mentioned, in the Ministry of Health. To realize the health system profits, there is need to maintain commitment to and focus on Paris principles or Paris Declaration. And these are the principles of effectiveness and use collective leverage with other donors and global funding initiatives. Thank you.
Thank you for starting a provocative dialogue. Again, we're going to be a little bit... don't worry, we're going to start the discussion very soon, but we'll have two more speakers. So I give the floor to Minister Tedros from Ethiopia.
Good afternoon. I would like to thank the International Aid Society for giving me this opportunity actually to be a member of this important panel. I think a lot has been said by the two speakers who have spoken before me. First, I would like to start by saying HIV/AIDS funding or HIV/AIDS program is not weakening the health system, and it's rather actually strengthening the health system. And yesterday in one of the panels, I have tried to outline specifically what Ethiopia has actually benefited from this great opportunity. HIV/AIDS program cannot be successful without a stronger health system, and a stronger health system will need actually financing in order to become robust. So I have outlined yesterday on how we use the HIV funding actually from Global Fund, from PEPFAR in strengthening our health information system, which is a brand new information system, our pharmaceutical system, expanding our health facilities, building thousands of health institutions, equipping them, training of tens of thousands of health workers, and I'm a witness that the HIV/AIDS funding actually has benefited and strengthened our health system. However, despite saying this, or while recognizing this, we should also try to address some challenges that we have actually identified in the process of our design in Ethiopia, the harmonization and alignment. In the harmonization and alignment process or exercise, we have identified some problems linked to different planning procedures, different financial and procurement procedures, different reporting mechanisms required by our development partners, and as a result of this, several or many transactions actually that affect our efficiency. And not only this, but the funding that we're getting is not actually predictable. And if suddenly is withdrawn, that could also affect the whole program. And in addition to lack of predictability, the inadequacy of volume is also one important challenge that has to be included in the finance architecture. These are some of the important problems that we have identified when we witnessed it, when we developed our compact. And to address this problem, we have started from preparing our plan, which is the HSDP plan, based on country priorities, and we focus on areas that we believe should be a priority. It's not only HIV which is exception, TB is an exception, malaria is an exception, maternal health and child health. So we have identified this as priority areas, and what we suggest is for future alignment and harmonization and planning, budgeting and reporting based on that should actually be in line with the plan. It all starts from the plan. And we have also identified as a solution the preferred funding modality, which is a pool fund, and we call it MDG Performance Fund. Until now, I think it's the Gavi which has joined this pool fund, and we expect other partners to join. Of course, the compact is under development. And the other issue or the solution is to have a predictable financing. What we're proposing is actually 5 to 10 years preferred financing or funding, but with a minimum of three years, and we're expecting development partners to commit to this. And another issue with predictability is if any development partner withdraws, to have a mechanism like using swing donors to address any withdrawal of funding in the process. And the above issues which I indicated actually can help us in minimizing transactions, in ensuring predictability, and ultimately in sustaining the successful programs that we have started with the support, the unprecedented support of the international community. And the other issue that has to be brought as a solution is there should be accountability based on one results framework, and that's what I said, the reporting. And to sum up, in our harmonization and alignment, we're actually the ultimate goal is we're saying one plan, one budget, and one report, and base it on focus of priority areas in which HIV/AIDS is one. So from the government side, then, there should be transparent and fair and accountable system, and better finance management, and increased government contribution to ensure sustainability. These are among some of the list which are also expected from our side. And this harmonization process, we started it in 2005. We signed a code of conduct in 2005, and then we developed a harmonization manual, which was endorsed in 2007 May. And based on that, actually, we have attended the first wave of International Health Partnership meeting that was called by Prime Minister Gordon Brown. And after that, we have developed a roadmap in January 2008, and that was followed by the development of a compact, which is almost in its final stage now and ready to be signed actually at the end of this month before the high-level meeting in August in Accra. So the negotiation and the discussion has been there since 2005, and now we're August 2008, and it's almost finalized, and many of our partners have actually committed to signing the compact. And we know actually that harmonization and alignment is actually a process, and it needs time. It cannot happen overnight. It started with a political push in September in London, and we believe that, and we suggest that political tracking is also important, because the best medicine for alignment and harmonization is actually politics, and that's why we suggest, in addition to the start, you know, with political push, the tracking should also be political, but we have to also recognize that it's a process, and several development partners who are supporting HIV/AIDS and others will be at different stages, some of them ahead, some of them in the middle, some of them behind. But since this is a process, we ultimately expect that we can reach the one plan, one budget, and one report to really have effective country-led, country-based programs which can even deliver more results than what we're witnessing now. Thank you very much.
And then I give the floor to Alvaro Bernejo, who is the Executive Director for International HIV AIDS Alliance. And then we'll have a discussion.
Many thanks, and good afternoon to everybody. The Minister of Lesotho was saying how daunted she felt. I can say I feel privileged and equally daunted for an organization that's working mostly at community level to be sharing a panel with so many ministers and ambassadors and talking about global financial architecture. But I'll do my best to try and present that community perspective. The first thing I wanted to say in this discussion is that in many of the countries we're talking about, out-of-pocket expenditure actually represents the biggest share of total health expenditure. And that is not something inevitable. That is not something that happens just because countries are poor. That is a direct result of specific policy choices that the international community and individual national governments have made. And I hope that will be picked up in this debate by the panelists. The second point I wanted to make is around partnerships and around the paradigm shift that happened 10 years ago, or maybe a good milestone would be Okinawa G8 meeting in the year 2000. I think from a partnership perspective, that was a time where we began to understand that the energy, the resources that would fuel and guide the transformational change that the response to infectious diseases required could only come from a partnership, from a movement of solidarity that involved affected communities, engaged civil society organizations, the private and public sectors, in a way that had never done before. The point I want to make today here to the panel is that I believe that that partnership that was built in 2000 is at risk of breaking today. And I'd like to highlight to the panel the three points that I think most of civil society partners, key activists and implementers in the partnership, would highlight as necessary to keep that partnership alive. And I would hope that out of this conference, we leave with a commitment to keep it alive. The first point that I think is important is additional resources. We know very well, lots of studies have shown solid evidence that the effectiveness of health systems is directly related to a country's annual health expenditure, up to a threshold that different studies put at $40 per capita to $60. But we know they can't be effective at 14. The second point that's important is there needs to be greater ambition and better targeting of national health plans by the respective governments. It cannot be that our own governments lack the ambition for human development of our own people. We spend huge amount of times in international meetings. We have hundreds of studies and reports discussing what interventions to prioritize with $14 per capita per day, per year. There are debates that pitch parts of the health community against each other. We spend far fewer time, money and effort, exploring the strategies and the partnerships that would deliver the necessary resources. It's focusing on the wrong question, and as I say, if we continue doing that, it will destroy the partnership. And I want to say that today when I'm very happy that one government, the US government, has committed many more resources to the respond. I have to say that I say it at the same time with the fear of having learnt a new word in the AIDS context, which I was discussing with my colleagues here in the panel a minute ago. For the first time in the AIDS response, I started hearing the word backloading. I thought this was some new sexual practice that I would need to explore and learn. I only found out last week that this was referring to governments that have taken praise for long-term commitments, 10-year commitments, now beginning to explore whether instead of paying next year, can we pay 8 years down the road? I had never thought that that could be even in the dialogue for HIV/AIDS. The second point I'd like to highlight as important to keep this partnership alive is convergence. The AIDS response, all of you in this room and in the conference, have opened a sense of possibility. I'd like to highlight that AIDS advocates have always been health systems advocates. People living with HIV need strong health systems. They know that. Their life requires uninterrupted drug supplies and diagnostics. They have sexual reproductive health needs and rights, just as anybody else. They suffer more from TB than the rest. They know what happens when the health worker dies or leaves the clinic and is not replaced. They care about that. My message here would be forget the versus horizontal debate. It is not helpful and it takes us nowhere. Let's build on the transformative power that the AIDS movement has proven. Let's build on it rather than against it. That's how we can transform health systems. My third point is around accountability and participation. The AIDS response in general, and the Global Fund in particular, have developed mechanisms that provide the civil society sector the ability to track commitments, disbursements, and results in a way that is unprecedented in global health. Lessons of participation, of reaching out and engaging the different sectors and communities, are difficult ones that the policy dialogue around sector-wide approaches and PRSPs will have to learn quickly if the partnerships, the solidarity that has characterized the fight to control AIDS, TB, and malaria is going to extend to global health. But I do understand that civil society sector cannot just demand. It has to adjust and transform itself for this new phase. And I'm happy to say that it's beginning to do so too. Greater collaboration, better representation of the sector at the global level and at national level are all really important. Greater coherence is needed, and work is being done through a process that we're calling the Free Spray process to try and achieve that. We need to link better to global health processes at both at national and international levels, and we are finding ways to do so. No doubt that understanding and being truly committed to greater impact requires from NGOs and from other types of organizations the transparency that the Minister from Lesotho was calling for and the courage to honestly examine how they can scale up and be more effective in today's changing environment and context. It does require for us too to take innovative bold steps and think out of the box. Very proud to say here today also that the international two international HIV/AIDS related NGOs, the alliance that I represent and the Health and Development Networks, HDN, are announcing today that they are in advanced merger talks. The merger will bring together a substantial country presence and increased exchange, dialogue, and advocacy capacity. The result will be faster learning, more coherent civil society voices, and more effective community mobilization. Many more organizational mergers of this kind are required in the health and development sector and should be anticipated in the near future. Let me conclude right now by saying it again. With increased resources, with accountability for outcomes, and with civil society engagement, we can transform health systems, transform global health in a similar way to what we've done for the AIDS response. If we have all of this, the partnership that started in the year 2000 will continue to the benefit of people living with HIV and all those that are currently excluded from access to health services. But without this, the multi-sectoral partnership that has characterized this response to infectious diseases since Okinawa will break. Thank you.
Thank you. Maybe some other panelists can now react briefly to some of the questions that Alvaro and the two ministries have already raised. And if I can synthesize at least some of the questions, basically what they ask is, how can you make the life of the ministries of health and maybe also the life of a Ministry of Finance, and which is even more important maybe, the life of people doing the work on the ground a little bit easier in a context where we know that the global context, especially the global economic context, is not going to be very favorable to help make things of all these people easier. So maybe we can have some reactions. Malcolm, you want to say something?
I think that the points that are being made are very valid. I think the difficulty that I notice is the gap between the theory and the practice. I don't think there's any disagreement in the theory about the need for Paris Declaration principles and so on to be made a reality. But then when you get down to country level, as the minister mentioned in her talk, then I think that's where the difficulties start to arise. So I believe that we have a great deal of work to do to carry that forward.
Iro, you want to add something on this?
Yes, I'm not sure whether I can contribute, but sometimes WHO is as technical assistant agency. We are called by health minister to help, to write up the report and so on. And I gave you one example of my colleague in one country. He is receiving 700 delegates and countries and donors and multilaterals per year to have study missions. So he is a little bit tired. So we are helping them, and perhaps as sort of changing global architecture, a simplified approach will be much well appreciated. And the WHO is here to help the Ministry of Health. Thank you.
Joe, you want to add something?
This is an absolutely critical issue. I think some comments were made this today that we are actually at a very, very important, I think, turning point in the history of our struggle and our battle and our response to the HIV/AIDS epidemic. The challenge that is facing us now puts us in a position where we can actually make an informed choice to learn from the innovations that HIV/AIDS have brought. Like the three ones, like the ability to get the public, private, and civil society sectors working together. Now we have instruments that we have developed, which are the poverty reduction plans, which have got a comprehensive monitoring and reporting framework. Now if we were to bring this together with the lessons from HIV/AIDS, on how to work with civil society, how to work with the private sector, how to engage all this in a comprehensive framework that everybody that body can buy into and hold, be held accountable to, then we can actually get poverty reduction plans that will benefit the economies as a whole. It is not going to be easy, it's going to be extremely difficult, but I think we have to bite the bullet. If we don't do it now, all the gains that we have made in HIV/AIDS are going to fall apart, because the current environment is not sustainable. I mean, having so many different stakeholders and so many monitoring and reporting frameworks at country level is totally unsustainable. The comment that was made by Minister Tedros Ghebreyesus about swaps and medium-term expenditure frameworks and the need for, and I think you made the same comment, Honorable Minister, that we need to expand this. I see this as a challenge for us in the bank, that we need to accept that engaging with the public sector alone when developing these tools, these development tools at country level, is not going to get us where we need to go. But in order for us to get there, to have swaps, medium-term expenditure frameworks that bring in development financing from HIV/AIDS, from tuberculosis, from malaria, we need to be able to bring partners around the table and help them be led and be held accountable by the minister. And that is where the rubber hits the road. And I would agree with Minister Gebreyesus that the compact that he has had, his donors signed, the test is, are we going to be hold ourselves accountable? Are we giving him the power to hold us accountable? And are we holding each other accountable so that we can make this this sustainability of financing work better and harmonization and alignment work better for countries? This is really where the test lies, and I would agree that we need to step up to the plate and to respond to this.
Mark Michel, how can we reduce what us economists call transaction costs associated with the organization and management and administration of programs and reporting? Michel, you want to?
Two, three thoughts here. First, I see the Global Fund basically as an upstream swap. Donors are coming together to fund HIV/AIDS, TB, and malaria. And then we, on behalf of the international community, dialogue with the country, respond to the country requests, Ethiopia, Lesotho. And my question is then turned to our bilateral colleagues and donors, DFID and Holland. What guides your choice? What is the what makes you give part of your HIV/AIDS commitments to bilateral programs versus, let's say, to the Global Fund? Because when it comes to swap in Mozambique that the Honorable Minister from Lesotho was mentioning, this brings together around the table, I think, close to 20 partners, including for basically all of these donors, bilateral donors that come together to take any single decision about the disbursement, the same donors as those who participate to the Global Fund. So it is fine to the Global Fund. I mean, we're engaged in every single discussion about harmonization and alignment, and we hear your message, and we're totally committed to do as much as we can to harmonize and align. I'm just asking the question then to our bilateral colleagues. Do we want to harmonize at the country level? By having circles of donors at the country level, taking decisions, as in the Mozambique swap, in which case, fine, I want still, as Joy has said, that we are sure that we not only dialogue with the government on the government-driven and approved plan, but we're really talking to a comprehensive plan on which every stakeholder in the country has participated, and that we have the accountability, the transparency, the results-oriented perspective that is indeed the lesson from learned from AIDS. But I think the transaction costs are there as well. Why don't we go upstream swapping rather than downstream swapping?
Before maybe our British and Dutch colleague, Mark, do you want to add something on this?
A couple points. First, I think we do need to recognize that HIV/AIDS has probably done a better job at harmonizing indicators and other aspects of development than virtually any other sector. And we should acknowledge that. Now, we can do better, but I think there's been extraordinary effort there. You know, I get Michel's point, and as I've told him, I actually think the Global Fund and the Millennium Challenge Corporation are the true heirs to the Paris Declaration, the Monterey Consensus, but it's going to take us a while to get there. In the meantime, we need to figure this out in country, and this is preempting a little bit what I'm going to say, but I think where we need to go is into the country. The countries see all the requirements. The countries see all the reports. It's there that we can actually come together with a coherent picture, which would then go back centrally and tell us how to do this. I think we actually spend a little too much time in the international sector trying to figure all this out when it can actually probably be worked out better in the countries and then feed back up to us. So I think we really need to focus heavily on the countries. But for the long term, I think I agree with Michelle. In the long term, in a longer horizon, we should be doing upstream approaches that are self-harmonized almost.
The for DFID, there is almost a 50% split between the funding that we give for bilateral and the funding that we give multilaterally. And that is because we believe that we need both of these strings to the bow. We believe that the bilateral programs can make a difference at country level. But we recognize that multilateral partners are extremely important as well. But we do our very best to try to make sure that the policies are consistent across both bilateral and multilateral. And I think that's where the Paris Declaration is so important for us, because it gives an opportunity for that harmonizing at country level. And to go beyond just rhetoric about sharing and harmonizing our narrative and financial reporting systems, to make it a reality that we will function together at country level. And I think that DFID will probably continue that way, splitting about 50-50.
Mr. Kunders, do you want to add something?
Maybe a few words. I think the real key on all this is the country level. If we talk about harmonization and alignment, and these are terms that are not, we don't all mean the same by those terms. And we can think about the mantra of the Paris Declaration, and I'm very much in favor of it. We support it politically, but it means something. It means giving up sovereignty. It means a political will to work with the country systems, through the country systems, and have an accountability system in place in the country itself. In my view, if you look to the big questions that we have around AIDS, which we look towards throughout this conference, the only real area where you can harmonize and align is at the country level. There's no doubt about it. If you look to the different experiences, the relationships of what we call health systems, which is already something different in different countries, because it's also a container. It's not an easy, we can say health systems. I agree. Many of the things that have been developed through the AIDS movement have been very good in actually establishing sorts of health systems in countries. At the same time, we have to realize that a lot of the cooperation we do in terms of health, budget support, sectoral support on health, has to be aligned now with the next stage of how we deal with AIDS funding. And therefore, I think I am still afraid somewhat for this disconnect. And that's why I wanted to create some attention to it. It doesn't take away of what you have been saying. I mean, I think, I don't know the exact figures of my own country even, but obviously, our funding is mainly also through the World Bank and UNAIDS and the Global Fund. And I think you also have a specific responsibility in ensuring that many of the orphans in the distribution of funds of AIDS are not forgotten. Because that's a problem. In many of these countries, there is no discussion about budget support or alignment, especially in those fragile states where there is underfunding. We need to think about different structures and ways of doing this.
Thank you very much, Mr. Minister. And I think we automatically now are entering into the second phase of this debate. We now have heard the views of the recipient countries and implementing agencies, and we would like now to continue and asking the views of the donor governments and financing mechanisms. I would like to suggest it's for the speakers. You can either use the space over there. You can also speak from here if you feel more comfortable. We'd like to ask Ambassador Mark Dybul and Professor Kazachki, Michelle, Malcolm McNeil, and Joy Pumapi to give us their views. Mark, may I ask you to speak to us first? Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for the freedom to sit here, because I am more comfortable here. So, this is an extraordinary panel of tremendous views. But, I just among the panel, plus everyone in the audience, I don't think we could count the number of panels and discussions there have been on global architecture. And I feel a little bit like Dostoevsky and, you know, Notes of the Underground. It's all been said before. You know, we do nuances and learn a little bit more, but it's all been said before. And we have the historic documents to show us the way. We have the Monterey Consensus, the Paris Declaration, the multiple G8 commitments, the three ones, the Global Task Team, the UN General Assembly documents. They're all out there, and the basic principles for how we solve global architecture are outlined there. If we follow these principles, we can solve the issues of sustainability. We can solve the principles of health systems versus disease-specific, of links to development. The basic principles, which Alvaro talked about, are begin with partnership, going beyond donors and recipients to true partnership between equals with mutual responsibilities and obligations for all partners involved, not just one partner, but all partners. It begins fundamentally with country ownership. It is throughout all of these documents. That's the principle, country ownership through partnership. To get there, all sectors need to be involved, not just governments, but non-government, faith, community-based organizations, the private sector, good governance, results-based accountability. These are the principles that move throughout all of these documents. And if we follow the principles, and if we meet the specific commitments we've attached around those principles, we will get over all of these things we continue to meet about and discuss. And I agree completely with Minister Kunders that we will solve these problems by taking those principles and commitments to the field and having it solved at that level. And that reminds me a little bit about Dostoevsky too, because in the end, the Grand Inquisitor really didn't trust people, really didn't put his faith in the common person who seems common, but with a little support will do extraordinary things. And I think many times we say these things, but aren't quite sure we really believe it. But if we really put our trust and faith in the ministers who are sitting here, in the alliance, in the public, private, faith, community-based organizations in the field, if we really take those principles and hold everyone accountable to them, but then turn it to the field to achieve them through our commitments, they will work out how to manage health systems and HIV/AIDS. They will work out how to link all the other aspects of development together. They will work out how to have a coherent monitoring and evaluation framework. And so if we take all of what we've agreed to already and move it to the field, I think we can solve all of these things by following the principles and keeping to our commitments. And to understand there's no one solution. Swaps may work in some countries, not in other countries. There might be different mechanisms and different solutions. We can't predetermine all that, and countries shouldn't look to the international community to solve that, and we shouldn't try to provide them with that solution, but let them work it out. So I actually have one recommendation, and I can make it because I might be leaving office soon, so if everyone's mad at me, it's okay. My one recommendation is that we commit to a moratorium on any more meetings on global architecture, declarations, communiques, commitments, until we have met the commitments we have already made. And when we meet, it should be to hold ourselves, all of us, those in country, in the global, accountable, and to measure and mark what we do, but to look to the countries to solve the problems. And to be honest, if we did that, imagine how much we could reduce our carbon footprint, which would contribute to another commitment we've made. So my plea is that we move to the field, that we trust, that we believe in what we know to be the case, that we are all privileged to be partnered with and support some of the most extraordinary people on the planet. And if we live that way, if we begin, like we did a while ago, as Alvaro said, dreaming big, thinking big, believing in each other, grasping for the future, having the openness of spirit to come together to break down barriers and solve our problems, we will meet those commitments, we will achieve those principles, and we'll change the world.
Thank you very much, Mark. Well, ladies and gentlemen, you heard that the meeting is over. This was the moratorium has just started. Strong words, Mark. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. The issue is, what you're saying is, leave it to the countries, give the confidence, leave it to them, and let them work it out. Everything has been said before. It's there. Let the countries take the responsibility. Michel, can I invite you to give your views?
Thank you. Thank you, Paul. Okay. Does this work? No. It works now. Okay, thank you. Thank you for having me also part of this debate, and thank you to all for the remarks we've heard so far. I can't agree more with you, Mark, that this is one more of these debates, whereas when it comes to principles, they remain, they stand strong. It's just us not getting to have them translated into the practicalities of everyday's life, that is, of the relationship with a bilateral or a multilateral donor with a country, or of the bilaterals plus the multilaterals at the country level. Let me, at this point in the debate, just say a few words on some of the issues that have been discussed so far. One is that of health systems, the other that of harmonization, and perhaps that of sustainability. When it comes to health systems, thank you, Alvaro, for your strong words. I can't agree more. AIDS, one of the lessons learned from AIDS is that really it is a revealing, a disease that has been revealing so many dysfunctions in societies and in the way societies work. And one of those dysfunctions is the weakness of health systems. So the scaling up of AIDS treatment and AIDS prevention has revealed more than ever before a pre-existing weakness of health systems that has been there because of years of underfunding of health systems. Years of underfunding of health systems because it was years of people considering health as an expenditure instead of considering health as an investment for development. And I'm surprised that even here we come again and hear that word distortion by vertical funds. There is no distortion by vertical funds. Yesterday at the session, Dr. Atun presented a scientific analysis, what we call a Cochrane review of the available data. There's just no evidence, there is no evidence that vertical funds have been distorting health systems. There's just evidence that vertical funds are confronted when it comes to scaling up to the intrinsic weakness of health systems, and we all bear a collective responsibility here. So let's stop arguing here. Too much time spent on fighting within the health movement about these issues. Now, I think the AIDS, and of course the AIDS-TB and malaria, as Global Fund, I'll just broaden, of course, the debate to AIDS-TB and malaria, I think has, as again was discussed yesterday evening, contributed very significantly to health systems strengthening. And I think Global Fund, PEPFAR, Gavi have been and are and will be fair and strong partners there in the long-term perspective. And that contribution to health system strengthening, let me digress for a second and talk about a question you asked, Alvaro, if I'm not mistaken, is about what we call health systems. And to me, of course, health system is much broader than what Ian Grubb suggested to call the hardware of health systems, that is infrastructure, health workforce, procurement capacity, monitoring and evaluation. Health system is also the people who are in the system, and the people is also the civil society, and it's the communities of people living with the diseases. And so funding the civil society, and 40% of the Global Fund money goes to fund civil society, funding the communities, strengthening the communities is part of strengthening health systems. And that respect, I believe PEPFAR, Global Fund, Gavi, again, if you look back at the last... Whoops, I was cut. Okay. If we look back 4 or 5 years, have been extraordinary and unprecedented funders of what was underfunded previously. Let me also mention here social protection, and that, Alvaro, is something that was behind your words, I suppose, when you talked about free access to healthcare for all and fighting the intolerable weight of out-of-pocket expenditure for people. So, and again, some of those disease-specific, let's call them that way, funders, been also in funding social protection and health insurance schemes. But of course, I think Global Fund cannot do it alone, and Global Fund and PEPFAR and Gavi cannot do it alone. We need all the other donors coming here, and we need, of course, you, the bilaterals, coming either upstream or downstream, and then we'll talk about how we harmonize and align. And we need the countries also, the countries that need to come up to their Abuja commitments for African countries. And we need so many countries throughout the world to really also take their commitments about health seriously. I've just been traveling in Latin America prior to coming here, and I've seen budgets for health being somewhere between 3.5 and 5% of the yearly budget of the nation, far from where we would hope them to be. And we also wish to see the World Bank's perspective in this joining of us in funding. So again, enough of that debate. I think what brings us together, and that's I hear more and more in all our discussions, and in particularly in our discussion at what we call the immodestly called the H8, where Joy and I join some the heads of the other health agencies, it is the health-related MDGs. I think this is what brings us together. It is have health and health-related MDGs as the core of our advocacy, and that advocacy can then lead us to actually use all the various channels that we have to fund HIV/AIDS, TB, malaria, health systems, maternal and child health. Let's really keep to our and focus on our commitments, and let's advocate around health-related MDGs. When it comes to harmonization and alignment, I can't agree more with what has been said by all of us again, and Mark, you said it well. The commitments are there. The ways to go are there. But we still keep in the rhetoric, and we don't go to the practicalities. We as Global Fund have been part of all of the discussions, the three ones, the GGT, the discussion on swaps, the HA, the IHB, all of the initiatives. But to me, at this stage, if in the medium and the long term, I'd like to put again the question of whether we should swap upstream or downstream. But in the immediate and in the short term, I'd like to make 3 points. First, the Global Fund is providing extremely flexible money to countries. And you, Minister Tedros, have clearly illustrated that. And this is what you have said. You have used the flexibility of Global Fund money to really bring together funding of health systems and disease-specific funding. If, Madam Minister, you wish us to commit to a swap, as we did in Mozambique, We will do so again if we are certain that everyone is involved in the national plan, that the transparency, the accountability, the results oriented perspective are still there. And then, as you, I suppose, all know, the Global Fund is now moving from a program-based approach or a project-based approach to a concept of funding national strategies. And national strategies in the broad sense of the term, be it a national strategy on AIDS, a national strategy on TB, or a national health strategy. And I think these strategies are just the pieces, Tedros, of the puzzle that you bring together in the compact. So this is to say that I really see, despite the difficulties, us really coming together somehow here. And I'd like to share some of Mark's optimism. We do have the principles, and we are now seeing some of the mechanisms of coming together. As I said, bringing together these national strategies will help you build your compact. And we will and will remain a fair and strong partner funding your AIDS, your TB, your malaria strategy, together with the necessary health system components within your overall health plan for the benefit of the Ethiopian and Lesotho population.
Thank you very much, Michelle. Thank you very much. And before I give the floor to Malcolm McNeil, thank for the audience for the many questions that are coming to us. What we do is we have Craig McClure select a few of the questions. So when we come to the discussion, we try to combine a couple of the questions when we come to the discussion. Malcolm, the floor is yours.
Thank you. Forgive me for standing up. It was just that we have a curve in our seat, and we were going to be talking to with our backs to most of the audience, so please forgive me for standing up. You probably guess from my accent that I come from Scotland, and I have to give apologies from Douglas Alexander, who's our Secretary of State, who was hoping to be here but couldn't be here. He's also from Scotland. And Gordon Brown, our Prime Minister, is also from Scotland. So the Scottish plan for world domination is making some progress at the moment. Yes. Yeah. I'm not going to repeat what many of the distinguished panelists have said. The UK announced in June a new strategy for HIV and AIDS, and there was some controversy in what was announced, because we announced that we would provide approximately $12 billion for health systems, including HIV and AIDS and other services. This was thought to be a demonstration that the UK might be moving away from its commitment to HIV and AIDS. Nothing could be further from the truth. But we are looking at the overall financing that different agencies, both bilateral and multilateral, are giving. And we recognize that there is a great deal of need to build up funding for health systems. I'd also like to congratulate Mark Dybul for the launch of PEPFAR 2. I think that's a remarkable achievement, and we look forward to working together. But we still have significant obstacles in achieving universal access. I would like to put it to you that not enough has been done to ensure that the funding we have is effectively coordinated. We have to respond more to the national plans under the 3-1s principles. We know that in many countries there is limited institutional and absorptive capacity. That's particularly true in the less developed countries, and in the fragile states. And large, uncoordinated programs which operate separately inevitably create distortions. And I think we need to start listening to the messages that are coming from the ministers themselves, because they recognize when the distortion actually takes place. DFID believes that strong health and other social sector systems are going to be critical in the long-term scaled-up response to AIDS and all the other aspects of reproductive health. There's a critical need for governments, national governments, to play a leading role and not be pushed into the back seat as back seat passengers. And we also have to effectively involve and fund NGOs and civil society. It's not just about funding for the public sector, it's about funding for those other actors as well. And we also have to do far, far more than we've been doing to make GEPA principles a reality. So is there cause for any optimism? Are there signs that we're starting to learn the lessons? Well, I think yes. I think we can say that we're starting to learn the lessons, but much remains to be done. Paris Declaration cooperation is still more theory than reality in many of the countries. And all of the agencies, that's including DFID, that's including the UN system, that's including the Global Fund, and including the US, all of the agencies have to do more and better to coordinate more effectively. And I believe there's a need for far stronger leadership from the national level to force us to do that, especially in fragile states. I think we need to recognize that our progress has been patchy and disjointed, and in some places it's been extremely slow. I really agree with what has been said. We need to move away from diagnosing the problem and instead move into practical actions to implement solutions at the national level. I think there's a need for every one of us who are at the session today to pick up some action points that we can go away with and make a difference in our own countries and agencies. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. I gather this was the UK point of view, not only the Scottish point of view. Thanks, Malcolm. And may I ask Joy Pumapi to respond to us?
Thank you very much. I would also like to appreciate being given this opportunity to share my thoughts with you. My colleagues who have spoken before me have addressed quite comprehensively some of the points that I was going to raise. So I'll not repeat what has been said. But I would just like to raise the debate a little bit to, you know, the focus of today's discussion, which is the financing architecture. Does the current architecture in its current form and structure respond as effectively to the demands of this epidemic as is required? And will it sustain us in its current form for the long term? I believe that the only thing that is going to enable the varied financial structure that we currently have, which is extremely diverse globally, whether it is the Global Fund, which attracts resources from donors and other stakeholders, whether it is the soft windows or the grant windows that are open within the bank, whether it is the Gates Foundation, PEPFAR, etc., or a bilateral support from DFID or the Netherlands, that type of that global architecture has to be harmonized in some form or structure at country level for cost-effective use of these resources. That is a given. It's evidence-based. It's something we have agreed on. So the first our first concern has to be the efficiency gains that will be attained through harmonization and alignment at country level. It will be difficult, yes, but we have to do it. But my belief is that we are caught in a situation of overwhelming need. The current resources that are available internationally, locally, even with the tremendous sacrifice of those who are infected and affected at country level, at community level, who are paying out-of-pocket expenses at such high levels that they have been driven into poverty. The resources are not enough. They are not enough for the HIV/AIDS, TB, malaria, for health systems, for the MDGs, and that is the fact. And I think this message needs to be very, very clear. We are in as dire a situation now in terms of the need for resources as we were, I would say, 10 years ago, because the epidemic has grown since. 10 years ago, we did not have enough resources. And we needed less resources to respond to the epidemic then than we did now. It has grown exponentially. We know that for every two people we are putting on treatment, we are getting three new infections. So the need is massive. And I think this message needs to be very, very clear. Our challenge, therefore, is to ensure that not just that we harmonize and align at country level, but our challenge is to see how we can grow the resources and how we can sustain the current response for the long term and build on it and increase it. We have been given information on what the projected financing needs are. I will not repeat the UN figures, UNAIDS figures, you know what they are. But I feel that the second phase of our response, apart from cost effectiveness, apart from addressing the need for us to increase the sources of funding and to increase the funding from existing sources, is to make sure that we are funding the right areas effectively. We need to increase funding towards the funding of a vaccine, and redouble the scaling up of evidence-based prevention interventions that work. I would like to see a global movement, similar to the global movement that we had on treatment and care. A global movement that responds to an analysis that has been done by the Futures Institute, that $12,000 will be needed to invest in treating each positive person over a period of about 25 years. Whereas an investment of about $2,000 will be needed to keep people negative who are currently negative, or indeed to keep people who are still to be born negative. Now we need, as we have already said as a global community, that people have got a right to have access to treatment and to care. We have to say that people have a right to have access to prevention interventions. This has to be our next call of action. Because if we don't have that call for action, we are having an unsustainable financing situation with the exponential increase in the number of people who we will have to treat because they are dealing with this chronic condition, that is that is HIV/AIDS. I am aware that these are ambitious targets, but it is my belief that they can be attained through increased commitment by all of us, through ownership by countries of the challenge of financing this epidemic. It is totally unacceptable that with the evidence, overwhelming evidence that we currently have on the ineffectiveness of out-of-pocket payments in countries, we continue to accept out-of-pocket payments for services. And I feel that this, we really need to stop to stop this and appreciate that effectiveness of financing has to start with effective management of resources at country level. It does not start with effective management of resources globally. Effective management and use of resources at country level is what is going to determine the quality of the results, the ability to scale up, the enabling, the extent to which capacity can be built at country level, and the extent to which these results that we are going to achieve at country level will be able to attract additional resources. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Joy. Thank you. Very clear. That's good to hear that also the World Bank makes a statement that we need to reduce out-of-pocket payment. Thank you for that, for your very interesting contribution. And to just start off the discussion, we have a few minutes for discussion. I'm sure many want to reflect on what has been said. May I turn to Minister Ramatlapang and Minister Gebeyus, as we hear that country level, that is what the focus is all about. Joy was talking about the need for harmonization, alignment at country level. Mark was talking about taking a commitment to the field. Michelle was talking about the Global Fund, the importance of the countries to be involved. How would you respond to that, Mr. Minister?
I think we really are very gratified to hear Joy Pumapi talking about exactly the same things that we believe in, and also Minister Mark, Ambassador Dibble also mentioned exactly the same things. I agree entirely with that. How the harmonization, the partners have to agree to be harmonized for a start, and the governments have to take greater responsibility and also be open and transparent in dealing with the finances coming from the international partners. Harmonization is very important because planning, it doesn't matter what you do, you cannot plan on funding that you do not know. It is very difficult to plan on with a partner who is unwilling to work with you and to be open and to be on plan and budget. So I totally agree with all that has been raised today, and only saddened to hear that this has been said many, many times before, as Ambassador Adabel mentioned. However, we believe now that these things are being talked about, especially by the World Bank, because again, the World Bank also is guilty of the fact that they started this PIUs in countries, and everybody else followed. So it is very... We are really gratified to hear you say that, Joy Pumapi. If tomorrow you were to say to Lesotho, abolish the PIU that, belongs to the World Bank, everybody else will follow. So I am happy to hear you mention this.
Thank you very much. I also agree with most of what has been said by my colleagues, and I would also like to use this opportunity to congratulate Mark, my friend, for the success that was actually announced yesterday. This answers, by the way, what we have said, predictability, because it's 5 years funding, and of course we're asking for more, minimum 3 years, but five is, I think, really important. A very important commitment. Then when I come to some of the specific issues, maybe especially the country level, I completely agree the harmonization should be there,
And as what Mark has said, it differs from one country to another, by the way. We cannot prescribe the same thing to all countries. We can agree on a certain frame, but there will be a twist and turn. And even entirely, it could be different from country to country based on their own needs. There is no way, there is no like one solution or one side that fits all, and I agree with that. But what I believe is, whatever the modality could be, the country level harmonization is very, very important. That's the most important element. As many of you have already said it, harmonization, you're talking about harmonization, is not new. It has been there for ages now. Even the country level harmonization, for instance, since we started to really take it seriously and engage our partners, it's already more than 3 years. This is, we started in 2005, we're in 2008 now, and the compact is expected to be signed, of course, at the end of this month. We believe that this is one step ahead, but still, we don't know, or we don't know how this can be translated into action. I had some informal discussion with some partners yesterday, and many have some, I think, still, unclear issues on how we can really translate whatever is written on paper into action. But for countries, including Ethiopia, the most important thing is now the action, because the talking has been there for a long time now, and we want to really go into action and realize the principles of Paris Declaration and other principles that we have been discussing about. One more issue which I would like to address is, I think the government should really commit to increase funding. But I don't think it's a good idea, or although many countries have already committed to the Abuja target, and you may be surprised when I say this as a health minister, but I don't think that the 15% is actually the answer. Based on the formula that governments actually put for their country to get out of poverty, they can allocate something more than 15% or less than 50%. I can give you some example. For instance, if budget is allocated for the education sector, it's good for health, because they're training doctors, training nurses in big numbers. How would I advocate saying 15% for me when whatever the education sector is doing actually directly benefiting the health sector? And how would I argue for the 15% when the health ministry also helps me in the provision of safe water supply, which addresses lots of the health problems? So what we should be really sure about is whether governments are making the formula work to get their country out of mess, how the formula is working in a very efficient way should be the question, rather than a 15% or whatever percent that's prescribed for all countries across the board, which I don't think is the right thing. And at the end of the day, I think we should make sure that whether the formula is right for each country, and the country leaders to work as a team actually to make the formula work. That's the best approach. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Minister. Alvaro, I wanted to react.
Yes, thank you, Paul. I wanted in particular to say, having started the debate saying I'm concerned that the partnership might break, I have to say I'm very encouraged from what we're hearing here, very encouraging for here Joy raising the issue of out-of-pocket expenditure and committing to promote and fund policies that reduce out-of-pocket expenditure. As she has said, equity matters and rights matter, and it's very important to hear that and to follow that up. She has also made a very important sort of plea for additional resources, and let's remember we're focusing a lot here on alignment and harmonization. Additional resources, additional finance was part of those same documents that Mark was referring to, but we seem to talk much less about that. So my suggestion, Mark, if you don't mind suggesting a slight modification to your formula, is that we don't have any more meetings other than those that are about how do we get to 0.7% and to the Abuja targets. Those should be the only meetings we should still be having. How do we work together to raise the resources to levels that can sustain the health of our populations? How do we work together, ministries of health, civil society, private sector, donors, etc.? That's where we need to spend our time on. I'd like to disagree a little bit with Minister Tedros in the sense that I do see the concern about sort of fixed targets, but fixed targets help from an advocacy perspective. And the reality today, while I don't know if it's 15 or 14 or 16, what I know today is that 4% is not enough. However one looks at it, 4% is not enough and we need to increase it. Thank you.
Thank you, Val. May I turn to Minister Koenders? As he made, at his introduction, he made a couple of remarks of some concerns about a disconnect between the HIV/AIDS response, the border development agenda. Now, having listened to what we have been discussing over the past 1.5 hours, how do you feel about that? Do you feel that concern confirmed or not at all?
Well, the issue being, I mean, I was just listening to my predecessor speaking on, you know, his requirements to keep a compact together. I think that was actually a very crucial question. And I am actually quite positive about what has been said here around the table, but it makes me also a little bit worried, especially when it comes to terms like harmonization and alignment. I put it forward for a very good reason, and we all discussed why it is so necessary. But the debates tend to be a little bit depoliticized, if we use those words, because they are not technical terms. The solution to this problem is not working together better, but asking ourselves why we don't work sufficiently together right now. I think that's the key question, and that's a highly political question, where there are different responsibilities which we should be willing to address. That's why I think the issue of additional funds and the 0.7 is a key issue. And let me be very open about it. We're sitting here with three donor countries who are committed heavily to financing these arrangements. And I don't want to boast my own country because I don't feel that is, you know, we are not complacent at all. But there are many countries who are not sufficiently funding the international arrangements on the fight against AIDS. So when we look even at the figures at the OECD, I see a lowering of international aid. And many countries, big countries in Europe, but also in other parts of the world, are simply not up to what they have promised. It's a political question. Are we willing to looking into a world in which there are different threats and competing claims, from non-proliferation to terror to climate to I don't know what, to make exactly choices for the health MDGs? We've made progress. I think it's far not enough. So that's the first part of the compact, which really needs additional political attention. And it's not to name names, but it's also not to forget that this is a highly political question. Second, on harmonization is also giving up sovereignty. It's also giving up sovereignty from bilateral donors. I agree what you have been saying about that. We are making progress on this, but when we are going to be in Accra next month, we will see to what extent that is a meeting that simply is a meeting like this, in which we just say this is the stock and we should do better. Or we make it a political meeting in which we say which countries are really willing to agree with the partnership with the developing countries who take their own responsibility. And I'm looking at the papers for Accra, we're not there yet. And also there it's very key, and we know very much who doesn't want to work and who do. It's not that difficult to see. But I'm a minister from one of the countries, so I should be slightly diplomatic in this. The third issue, I think, is really also the responsibility of developing countries themselves. And they are, of course, fighting, first of all, especially those who are suffering most with AIDS, by putting the national programs correctly and giving the right priorities. Here I'm also in a problem, because we're here in a forum with countries that are doing quite well. I mean, I'm very impressed by what Ethiopia is doing in finding this synthesis with health systems and the treatment of AIDS. That was just discussed. And I agree, I said that also in my speech, let's end this ideological debate. Let's use the AIDS movement also to create progress. But let's not assume that in all countries it's not a problem. In Tanzania it was a problem. There were competing claims. It doesn't mean you have to choose for health system or for AIDS, but it was a real problem. And through this problem people suffered. If we don't mention that specifically, then we are wrong. The last point I really have to mention, and I tend to agree and disagree a little bit with my neighbor, he's right. All these figures and targets can become very stale.
And I think in a country where there is an enormous interest in reaching the health-related MDGs, you know, there is an individual choice to be made if it's more education or health. But I am baffled by the fact that in many countries in this continent and in Africa, the amount of money of the government budget which goes to these MDGs is so low. And if we don't address that and say we want a compact together, and we're very open for this, then we have a big problem, because then you won't have harmonization, because there will not be a national plan in which this is reflected. So, in short, my reaction to the debate so far would be that I'm very pleased that we have a language which is agreeing on the best approach, country-led, specific, in a compact with civil society, putting the health MDGs politically at the forefront. But it's not just leading, concluding from words into action. We have to really show why those actions don't take place. And I just wanted to mention very specifically some of these problems, because that's where the fight of this movement will have to be targeted at. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Minister. Thank you. And hearing the different points of view, especially between different countries, it is time always to look at the UN to make the right consensus. Now it's time for the third session. May I ask? Yes, you can.
So Michel Sidibé from UNAID.
No, thank you very much. You can realize that my accent is not a Scottish one. So, but I wanted just to say that probably we're missing one important thing here. We are in the crossroad in the fight against HIV/AIDS. After 25 years, this epidemic is revealing its complexity. We are, it's very important for us to understand that we have, of course, 3 million people on treatment, but if we continue with the same pace of our implementation rate today, in 2010, we will have only 4.6 million people on treatment, instead having 8.8 million people on treatment, which will cost us 12 billion a year. So it's very important to understand that this crisis or cost of maintaining those people on treatment will go by increasing if we don't work on prevention, if we don't avoid new infection. That is one first thing I want to say, which is very important for us to take into account. But this also cumulative numbers on treatment will call for different type of approaches, because we will need a stronger health system. It's impossible for us with the current health system and the current human capacities which are on the field to be able to provide the services to all those people. So we need to be able to leverage AIDS resources for probably reinforcing those capacity to produce this result for HIV/AIDS areas. Third, we didn't talk about the complexity, gender issues. It will be centrally a gender issues. How we will deal with this complexity is very important. It will be complex, and it will be costly. It will, this meetings reveals that the issues of vulnerable groups will become central. MSM, issues of sex worker, drug user, and we know today from our last report that we are not reaching them. 90% of the countries who have been reporting to us didn't report on MSM. So we need to also look at, in our financing approach, how we will reframe that, how we will redesign our resource allocation to be able to produce the maximum of result. And that will happen in only one condition. And we talk a lot about harmonization. I love this word. I was leading the global task team and others. But I think the major point we are missing here is alignment to national priorities, is how we will make sure that the countries will be able to come out with a prioritized, evidence-based, well-costed plan to oblige partners to align those resources to national priority, to avoid to have this scatter type of projectized approach, which is very costly, which is really creating a lot of burden, and which is not helping us necessarily to go to scale.
Thank you, Michel. I recognize my fellow economist in the sense that there are two ways to increase resources. One, which is what Alvaro has said, is fighting and advocating for more resources, but also, as Joy has very complementarily said, it's also showing that we can improve the way we use the resources we already have. And I'm convinced that the two are related. The more we will be able to prove performance-based funding, to prove that we use the existing resources very efficiently in having an increase in prevention, for example, the more we will be able to be effective in advocacy and reaching the 0.7. Hero, maybe we need your point of view as WHO and technical agency.
Thank you very much for giving me the floor. The reason why I come to this lostrum is that I would like to provide the first WHO's advice. That is WHO's function. Why don't you stand up? We need some bread after 2 hours. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. I think with able chairman, and already we had a lot of contributions. So I'm sure that we can leave this room with a good feeling of satisfaction. But I don't want leaving poor patient with deep vein thrombosis. That's why we have stretched. Okay. This leads to my first point. I think our colleague chair invited 5 comments. But for me, as a country where silence is golden, so my intervention is quite short. Usually, I describe change of global architecture in HIV, tuberculosis, malaria as explaining by only one cartoon. I come from the country where cartoon is very famous. The cartoon center is two big bear and football player. Do you know what I mean? And football player is getting even larger. And comparing that, UN agencies, including WHO, is small player in terms of budget. But we would like to be a good player and good contributor in such crowded and important field. That is our commitment. That is commitment of Director General. That leads to my first point out of 4. Number one point is norm and standard. So that is what WHO has been working for. But what is the norm and standard in HIV context? I think our contribution is something like standardized and simplifying HIV treatment, for example. That by this effort, HIV treatment is no more the kind of care provided by specialized clinics and hospitals. Treatment can be implemented in every communities. That is give our hope that universal access can be achieved. This is the kind of norm and standard we are working for. This is number one point which I wish to make. And the second point is that in global financing architecture, there are many goodwills and many large financiers are coming in. But we would like to make sure that funding to be sustained and getting even larger. What we can do? So that is our second question to ourselves. We feel that to give evidence. Take one example, ARI treatments. We tried to simplify and standardize treatment. There was some expert gave me some questions. Is it really all right? But our team has contributed to the Lancet magazine early part of this year. And the team demonstrated that our simplified approach on the basis of good, sound, clinical judgments is bringing similar results, which came from a very complicated laboratory exam-based approach. So it works. This is persuading evidence for the donors to continue to bring in funding. So this is kind of contribution which WHO wish to continue. The third point is relationship with disease control programs and health systems. We have heard lots about this, and that there is no more controversy of either horizontal, vertical, or even diagonal. Our director general said in his remarks at opening ceremony, she was very much appreciative and commending the work of civil society. Due to the civil society's activities, the architecture of HIV has been changed. New financing mechanism came. And the UN agencies are more than ever united with UNAIDS. And many partnerships are formed. That is a kind of legacy which you have made. But if we can continue such legacy, expanding to health systems development and disease control activities through primary health care, that you can add additional legacy. That is how we feel about. Lastly, I think I need to say a little bit, a few things, which is a little bit shameful for me, but I think due to very important donors and financial architectures are here, so I need to tell. The problem which UN agencies are facing now is that norms and standards continuously need to be upgraded. And also, these norms and standards, sometimes when at country level, when countries to apply, they need our support or advice. We call technical assistance. So this component is the growth rate is global fund is like jet fighter. And our growth rate is perhaps a little bit better than Cessna, like this. So I think Madam Joy Fumafi mentioned about need of further investment in of preventive care, prevention, and others, and also monitoring and evaluation is very important area, so that we can focus on target populations which deserve much better and rightly deserving services. So in order to do that, we need better monitoring and evaluation, which has been a little bit underfunding for these days. So my last message is help us to help you. Thank you very much for your kind attention.
And last but not least, Michel Sidibé.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. Let me start by just saying a few things about our role in this global financial architecture. I think we are providing evidence, which is very important. We are sharing what works, and we identified gap in programmatic response. We work to sustain political commitment. We make money work for the poor by mobilizing technical support. We also work closely with civil society to strengthen their capacity to ensure demand creation for services. We monitor, track financial expenditure and financial needs for the global response. But also, we improve mutual accountability by working with the countries to make sure that we can have government-led participatory reviews which reinforce their ownership. That is not really what I want to share with you today. I want to respond to your question. What are the key attributes of a good long-term financing strategy? Let me start by showing you a slide which captures well the sources of current global financing architecture with different boxes, if you can see it, which is not just showing the complexity, but which is also demonstrating that we are not spending too much time discussing to all different opportunities which are existing. We are talking today mainly about multilateralism and particularly some bilateral fundings. Like the Minister of Development Cooperation said, I think increased sustainable financing is one of the major obstacles for scaling up towards universal access. Even to the extent that some countries refrain from fully utilizing their scaling up capacity today. It is clear that the cost of scaling up is too high for poor countries to finance on their own, especially in the context of other development priorities. But not addressing the obstacles to universal access literally means that country will not achieve the Millennium Development Goals. The increase in international resources today has been remarkable, and the challenge is to build on this platform in a sustainable and predictable way. However, middle-income countries, we didn't talk about it, are not able to access a fair share of these resources, Honorable Minister. Increasingly, I am of the impression that we need to revisit classification and grouping, in particularly the criteria used for allocation of external funding. Social and vulnerability indicators must complement the economic and financial ones to better accommodate the constraints faced by countries with high GDP and or high disease burden. And I am pleased to notice that the Global Fund has applied already more flexible criteria for middle-income countries. Possible indicators for funding could include human capacity. We have been always talking about this human capacity problems for most of our countries. Is it true for Swaziland, who has more than 30% of infection rate today? Life expectancy, the crude death rate, agricultural output, food security, highly relevant today in our debates. I think disease burden, HIV, TB, maternal and infant mortality, and closely related to that, the humanitarian emergency to prevent social collapse due to the impact of HIV epidemic should be included in our indicators. Many of our countries will soon not be eligible for those funding we have been talking about today. So how can we sustainably be ensured what we are doing? HIV is a long wave event. The response and the impact are both long-term, and the financing must match this. There is a need to find broad-based and diverse source of financing in order to reduce the inevitable degree of fluctuation that may exist with any one sources. The burden, we heard that in from the panelists, of out-of-pocket spending, which is probably the most inequitable source of financing, need to be stabilized by promoting the use of prepayment schemes and risk pooling mechanisms. This includes private health insurance schemes and the expansion of social insurance that can reduce the current inequity of HIV spending. Country can increase the sustainability of long-term financing by minimizing their dependence on external sources. This means funding mechanisms to maximize and sustain the use of domestic for the HIV response. Global innovative mechanisms have potential for further growth and stabilization. Although their contribution is still relatively modest, innovative mechanisms such as airline taxes used by United are an important source of stable financing with considerable potential for growth without introducing undue distortion into global markets. Finally, it is important to increase the share of donor financing that flows through multilateral channels as it allows greater economies of scale and helps to guarantee a neutral attribution to the country most in need. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Michel. Thank you. And now we are starting to use the questions that were raised by the audience, and we will ask them to the panels, to the panel members. One was actually raised to Minister Koenders, but I think I'd like to broaden it a little bit and raise it to the whole panel. It's about the issue of the integration of HIV/AIDS into the regular, more traditional aid instruments, such as the PRSPs and medium-term expenditure frameworks. And the question would be whether or not that's even desirable. As one can argue, the AIDS response has been, relatively speaking, quite successful, and a strong connect with regular aid instruments would only perhaps slow it down. As somebody phrased this, do we really want alignment with the PRSPs? PRSPs need approval from the IMF, the World Bank. Do we want them in the driver's seat again? Have we learned our lessons from structural adjustment? Minister Koenders, do you want to be the first one to respond?
There's a lot of things linked to these questions. Look, I think we can talk a lot about the history of structural adjustment and the enormous movement that I think we have made since then to talk about, remember the movement of adjustment with the human face, the whole change in terms of policies that are necessary to have sufficient amounts of investment in the MDGs. I think that's the key criteria. My point was that there is a certain risk that if we continue the investing in the way we do it right now, and there is an increasing disconnect with something which is existing, if you like it or not, that might actually impair our possibilities to really come to systems of sustainable and predictable funding, alignment, and ensuring that there is sufficient accountability. So I'm not saying that we should force somehow this issue into, the mantras of PRSPs, because I fully realize that there are problems there. So far, the reflection of health priorities and also the priorities of this epidemic is insufficiently reflected in those plans. And the real key question is, why is that the case? Why is that the case? Is it because somehow, and I don't think the real reason is because it's been discussed in the IMF and in the World Bank. The question is, why are there PRSPs at the moment not responding in their priority setting towards something that we all see as an urgent need? Somehow there is something wrong with that. And therefore I think it is important to start discussing why this disconnect is taking place, because we can simply deny the fact that there is this difference. But I think then we are not able to cope with the problems we see right now in sustainable funding, in ensuring that it's related to health systems, in ensuring that our people are properly paid in terms of salaries, in terms of preparing the fact that there is not a further brain drain, in ensuring that in the plans civil society is taken on board. But I'd be very interested to hear colleagues on this question. It is a question where, and that I like in the way the question was put, there is not an easy answer. But thinking that there is not such a disconnect, I think, would be a grave mistake.
I think this is a very important question. I think what we have to appreciate is that the really defining moment in the struggle against HIV/AIDS was when UNAIDS advocated for a multisectoral response. And it is the multisectorality of the challenge of HIV/AIDS that makes it so complex to address, and that makes it absolutely paramount for the response to the epidemic to be fully integrated into the framework of the global national development agenda. That is absolutely paramount. You need social protection systems that fully integrate the mitigating the impact of this epidemic on poor women and children, and on orphans, and on the grandmothers that take care of these orphans. You are not going to be able to have this these types of frameworks properly addressed outside the national structures and frameworks. You are not going to have the educational system fully addressing the implications of HIV/AIDS in terms of human capital development, not just for health systems, but for addressing all the human development implications in terms of retention of the labor force, not just for health, but in the teaching as well, in terms of ensuring that you train people to be sustainable in food production, because you need that for treatment. Food and nutrition is absolutely critical to maintain treatment programs. What I'm saying is that I do not see any other long-term sustainable approach to ensuring that we comprehensively address the challenges of this epidemic without fully integrating the national AIDS frameworks or national AIDS plans into the poverty reduction and the national development plans. The World Bank and the IMF should not have the power to dictate to countries. They should not have that power. If anybody is giving them that power, please take it away, because they do not have a right to it. That power should be in the hands of countries.
Malcolm, you want to, and Alvaro, and then we'll go to another question.
Just to add that I think it's not enough just to have things integrated into the plan. The big issue is that when the government structures, civil society, NGOs, and the funding agencies, when they come together, they can only monitor a limited number of indicators. So it's absolutely key that the selection of these indicators accurately reflects the needs in the country. In my experience, some of the monitoring indicators for these broad-based programs are way out of date with the current needs and realities. So I think it's really important to have that negotiation process so that these indicators are tracked to make sure the plans are effective and become a reality.
I also wanted to contribute to the response forward. I think it's a very important question. And I would argue that probably part of the answer, at least, is in the process through which those PRSPs are designed, monitored, and implemented. And if that is true, which I believe it is, I'm saying it's part of the reason, then we have to get a consensus and an agreement that as we move towards that integration, we transform the PRSP design process, the degree of oversight that civil society has of them, and how the allocations are happening. I come from the experience that every time I go to a country and speak to civil society, I find 7-8 civil society leaders, all of which can tell me exactly what the Global Fund grant is, how much is dispersed, where the bottlenecks are. I do not find in civil society those that can talk about their participation in the PRSP, how implementation is going, how the rest is going. And I'm not saying keep it separate. I'm saying transform the PRSP process and let's bring them closer together. We can't have too many islands, I would agree, but we need to transform it in that.
Thank you, Alvaro, because it gives me the opportunity to make the link with a number of questions which all goes in the same direction. That also rings quite well in my economist mind, because If we hear about what the consensus of a panel with the previous discussion, there was a kind of convergence on the idea that it should be at country level with national plans and or harmonization through basically national planning, okay? And this, of course, rings well in my mind of French-trained economist. But I'm also a US-trained economist, so I know that sometimes planning also, or too much planning, kills innovation, kills decentralization. And so there are a number of questions at this 7 of 8, which basically raise that question. What will happen if more and more things go through this kind of national programs or national plans? What will happen of the role of civil society, of private sector, of decentralization? This was targeted towards mainly the two ministers of health, but I guess the whole panel should try to answer to that. So, Mark, you volunteer on this, and then maybe ministry from...
One of the points we were making is there's a consensus on what's needed for country ownership, which includes all sectors being involved. Part of the accountability isn't one way. It's not just the international partners, it's the countries as well. And the countries need to be held accountable for a multi-sectoral program that engages all aspects of society, that has a results base and a good governance. That's part of the partnership. We all have responsibilities, and it's not a one-way street. So it's not as if everyone's saying, just let the countries do whatever they want. It's we all will work together in partnership to create a program that they are leading. And that civil society engagement is an absolute key component to it. Same with financial commitments. I couldn't agree with you more, Alvaro. I was saying, my God, of all people, you know, financial commitments and goals have to be there too. And that's the same in country. And we all hold each other accountable. And part civil society engagement is part of that accountability.
I actually recognize the fact that engaging civil society is very, very important. The only problem arises when partners believe, especially bilateral partners, believe that they have to fund the country through the civil society. And the civil society is not ready to work with government. But the other way around, governments are, Global Fund is a very good example of that. Governments are happy to work with civil society. But there comes a time when we also need to engage on it, you know, there have to be transparency for all of us to be able to work together. I agree, even if it's all going to be channeled through government, everything can still be discussed with civil society. There is no problem with that. My view is, at this point in time, the funding of the Global Fund is all going through government in Lesotho. But civil society is engaged, they are well aware of all, and they have representation on the implementing board. So the problem is, what happens when, especially now in Africa, when we're having more and more democracy, I think there are countries that feel that they cannot fund governments. They still do not trust certain governments. I'll give you an example. EU decided to give Lesotho 8 million euros for orphans. And how did they decide to fund that? No, the government has no capacity. We'll put this money through UNICEF. This is fine, but this is taking 2 years to implement. The point is, at what time do we believe that we have to build, funding has to include money for building systems for the government? My view is, it can only be sustainable if we build the systems, even if it takes long. But I do not believe that we can only work with civil society. It has to be with all.
Yeah, thank you very much. It's a very important question. I think involving the civil society or empowering the civil society and using their potential to contribute to their country, I think is very important. The private sector, I mean all society or all members of the community of a given country should really work together, and there should be harmony and alignment among themselves to work to a better country. I don't think there will be any disagreement on that, and I don't think anyone will question that. But the problem is, as what the Honorable Minister said, I think countries are represented through governments. A government actually represents everybody, including the civil society. It's individual society, individual citizens and everybody. So if we talk about alignment and harmonization, it's better to really do it through the government, because you can make government accountable, and the government takes the responsibility of really involving, empowering, and having the civil society actually play a role in developing their country. And you cannot have in any given country multiple accountabilities. It's better to make even the civil societies accountable through the government. And in our society, in our globe, actually, in the history of this earth, governments actually play a central role in representing the whole population of their country and in realizing the dream of the collective dream of its people. And that's, I think, the best way to even think about harmonization and alignment. And when it comes to planning, for instance, the government could be accountable by seeing how the process was made. For instance, for health, we try to do bottom-up and top-down plans by involving grassroots. Also, it's not really strong. We need to make it stronger, and we need to make it really robust. But we are actually in the right direction. But I think it's the government that should take the responsibility. When someone from outside tries to use the civil society to directly to implement programs, I think it's like babysitting the government. This is the responsibility of the government to pull all members or players of its country to really engage in developing that country. And we should see it from harmonization and alignment side in terms of making the government accountable in terms of it could be democracy, it could be good governance. All these are interlinked, but it should be through the government. But a strong and very, enabling environment should also be created for civil society and the whole population actually to contribute to the development of their respective countries.
Thank you. I think Alvaro would be challenged to react to that. I see Minister Koenders wants to react first. Is it okay, Michel?
You know, we get now in a highly political debate, and I like that, and I'm also a politician. But now we have to really watch out what we're saying, because things are being, I think, put in one basket. Let's go back to the question that was raised by our French-American economist. There are good and bad governments in the north and in the south. There are good and bad NGOs. There are well-functioning and malfunctioning parliamentarians. And I'm not going to name names, but in different countries there are different mixes. At the same time, we have an epidemic, so we have to act swiftly. And it can only work when we work through people. I find, especially in the AIDS epidemic, that civil society has played a crucial role, sometimes against their own governments, against their own parliamentarians, because it was a taboo in their country, because it was not a priority of the government, and that's everywhere the same. That's not in developing countries or developed countries. We had it everywhere. The question you were raising now, what, and I think that's a sub-question, if we talk about sustainability, the issue of health systems, the issue of ensuring that in the whole follow-up at the stage where we are right now, what is then the proper role of government? In an ideal situation, in my deep conviction, public health is a public responsibility of which the arrangement should be set by the government, yes. But the government can never do it by itself. It has to be part of a contract with society. And therefore, in my view, what is a key problem here, in also the relationship between developing and developed countries, is that our terms are not sufficient anymore. I think I don't even like the wordings recipients and donors, not because they don't exist. Of course, there is a power difference. Otherwise, not one party is the donor and the other is a recipient. But I really feel that we're talking about a contract here, in which two sides are obliged to deal with certain issues. I have to show to my parliamentarians in my country that money spent on AIDS is really leading to an end of suffering in the people. In some countries, that can mean that it is better to work through NGOs than through government. Let me take the example of Zimbabwe. It's a very clear-cut example. In other countries, it's very different, where the government takes responsibility for the health of its citizens. Has to be discussed. It's not that we should decide this. In the case of Ethiopia, that's clearly the case. But even there, and in my own country, the government is not an entity which is reified and which stands loose from democracy and NGOs. Now, civil society in itself is also interesting. I see also another risk, which is also critical towards the way we do PR speech. I liked what you said about it. I think we have to deepen it and use some of the experience from the AIDS movement into the PR speech. But I think they are vital for the reasons that you mentioned. I see also sometimes that the local parliament is sidelined by picking some NGOs that are being listened to, but not to others. And then the parliamentarians, who might be part of the problem or part of the solutions, are sidelined. So let's have this to be a real debate about democratic functioning and how we can reach the health NDGs through a new social contract in countries between government, civil society, and their parliaments.
Alvaro.
I don't really have much to add to what the minister has just said. I think I very much agree with Minister Kenders. I have to say, I think even, as you've said, even in the best functioning governments, I mean, still in my country, that I'll use as an example of one that is functioning, still the way the Spanish government reaches injecting drug users is through NGOs. It does not see itself as the provider of services. It knows it will not be able to reach them, and it is fine. It understands that it is civil society that's best positioned to do that. My sense is one of the lessons, and I might be wrong, but one of the lessons that the AIDS response has taught is that broadening the concept of national sovereignty beyond governments is an important concept. Making sure that on the board of the Global Fund, it is not only governments that are represented, has added value to the response, it hasn't taken it away. Making sure that country proposals are not just submitted by the government, but signed off by other civil society players, has added value to the response, not taken it away. So I would hope that that is not perceived as governments not doing their role. This is about bringing in other players that are equally critical to the response and that can also represent MSM, parts of the societies that are very difficult for reasons that are understandable in some cases and not so in others, for the government to represent. Thank you.
Yes, Michel.
Sorry, yeah. I was really going to move along those lines very much. And as an answer to the question Jean-Paul asked us, let me just bring three points. First is that this... I think it's key to broaden the concept of ownership beyond just the government. And for at least three reasons. One is that we need consensus, and that consensus is in governance, in many instances, as you said, Minister, is more than just what a given government at one point would say. Second, it is implementation. We've learned what AIDS has taught us is that the civil society is capable of implementing, and there is an enormous reservoir of health workforce and implementing capacity that can be moved. And the third is about designing the policies. What the AIDS movement has also taught us is that the people who are primarily concerned are major contributors to the design of the policies. So, first answer, ownership has to be a broadened concept beyond the government to the civil society and the affected communities. The second answer is that we need flexibility. I agree with you, Jean-Paul, one of the fears of planning and over-planning is the lack of flexibility, and the AIDS history has also taught us that we need to adapt permanently our policies and our strategies. And the third point is that, yes, in the long term, I hope and I see and I believe it's necessary that we will integrate HIV, AIDS, TB, malaria in PRSPs. But let's also not forget that we're dealing with epidemics. And that I personally believe we will still need for a number of years to come a PEPFAR and a global fund and a level of exceptionalism. Let's speak about it, because we need to fight these epidemics that are treatable and preventable. At the same time, as we did today, we all move towards trying to integrate everything progressively. But let's not jump too fast from where we are into where we wish to be in some years, and let's keep some exceptionalism that is what really have proven in the last few years to be the way we can save the lives of people confronted with epidemics.
Yeah, thank you very much. I think there was some misunderstanding when I intervened. What I said is the contribution of civil society is very important, and we greatly appreciate that actually. And especially the HIV/AIDS activism has really changed our attitude. It was really a paradigm, and we really recognize that, and we should actually learn a lot from it to shape the other programs. That's clear. And when I come to the involvement of NGOs in implementation, I also agree that the government should do everything. I didn't say that the government should do everything. NGOs, civil society should also be involved in implementation, in activism, in everything in their society. What I'm saying is, but the government at the end of the day should take the responsibility. Because for me, which I differ with Azaro, is a kind of, the sovereignty is actually expressed through governments. And in Ethiopia, for instance, we really advocate for a developmental state, which we believe is good for us. And we're making a huge progress. It's becoming really different. And we're saying enough is enough now. And when you apply it to this one, all society, including civil society, all members of a country should be involved, starting from the planning and also in the implementation. Because we have to use the potential of each and every citizen actually to make that country different. So that's not a problem. The issue is, if we talk about harmonization and alignment, like what we have been doing before, I think it should be aligned through a country PRSP plan, which is owned by the government and all the civil society and NGOs contributing to it, instead of working in fragments from a money that's coming from outside, which I don't think will add up to certain significant in changing a certain country. So that's what I'm saying, and which I thought was the spirit of what we have been discussing. We are even saying whatever is coming from outside should be aligned. Then we said it should be aligned at country level. Then why wouldn't we say all members of the society in a certain country should be aligned? Because civil societies are members of that given country. So that was what I was saying. It should be aligned. It should be a strong plan. It shouldn't be in fragments. And at the end of the day, a country can only be measured based on the MDGs, for instance, certain indicators, whether it has made a progress or not. It could be in the avenue of democracy, good governance, its economic issues, social issues, health is being one. That's what I'm saying. So alignment at all levels. And we shouldn't really make it vertical and create fragmented activities, implementation through civil societies in any country. That's not the right way of doing it, because there will be duplication and fragments everywhere. And I don't think we will realize PRSP, which is owned by the government. And finally, to tie it up, for me, sovereignty is expressed through government. Even opposition parties, after running an election, say to the elected president or prime minister, my president or my prime minister, because it represents the whole country. And let's do it this way, but let's have also the global unity of really making a difference by also aligning vertically, and also in the country aligning vertically and horizontally. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Minister, for the clarification. Ladies and gentlemen, we have 15 more minutes. We gather one group of questions on the private sector. Then I want to turn to the panel to give the opportunity for final comments. Meanwhile, if the audience has really some hot questions, provocative questions, please let us know. You may also raise them yourselves. I challenge you.
And coming back to the private sector, as we have been talking about partnerships, partnerships that means bilateral governments, civil society, we have discussed the UN, the World Bank. We haven't really discussed the private sector. We often hear, does the private sector do enough in the fight against HIV/AIDS? A lot of they have commitment, but they could do more. That is often said. What does the panel think about that? We know that in the Global Fund they are heavily involved. Are they sufficiently involved, Michel? What do panelists think about that? Mark?
Thank you. And actually, if you go through the documents, part of the principles always include the private sector. And I think one of the problems is we haven't been very intelligent about asking and addressing the private sector what we want. If you think back in AIDS, for example, the private sector was among the first to actually support treatment programs in sub-Saharan Africa. They needed to do it then because others were not. Now we don't need the private sector to do programs. That's not what the private sector does. I think we need a new model to engage the private sector that focuses on their core competence and engages them in what we need from the private sector. So a couple of examples. One is workplace programs and stigma and discrimination and prevention, care, and treatment programs in the private sector, in the companies, whether they provide insurance or directly provide health care. They need to be doing that, and they all need to be doing it. And it's not that expensive, and there are a slew of data now to show that it's actually good for their own productivity and good for them. You can do good and do well at the same time. But then when we start to think about the other things the private sector is exquisitely good at, one of the fundamental issues is systems. Human resource systems, communication system, logistics system, supply chain management system. These are not things, if we're honest with ourselves, that governments and non-governmental organizations are particularly good at. They are things that the private sector is exquisitely good at, and we can access that type of expertise. The chair of Citibank told me that it's actually excess capacity for them. They have people who do this all the time. We can access them and use them to build systems. The third area is around what they can offer us in terms of programmatic excellence. Universities, NGOs are very good at developing the content, for example, around prevention. But in terms of messaging and making it real and alive and current, that's something the private sector is particularly good at. And they're very good at market research. You know, it takes us 5 to 7 years to figure out if a programmatic intervention had an impact on behavior change. If Coke introduces a new product, they'll tell you in 2 weeks if someone's using it or not. We don't use market research very well. And if we take prevention seriously and real combination, massive prevention to radically change human behavior, we need something like we did with smoking. We need an all-out assault from every aspect with mass media and every, not mass media alone, but every sector. And the private sector can do that. So I think we need to be a lot more intelligent while we ask from them and move away from these foundational small pilot projects, which were great 10 years ago, but that's not what we need from the private sector today. And if we engage them appropriately, I think they're more than willing, in fact, would love to do that, but we need to engage them better.
Yes, Joy?
I agree with all the comments that I made by Mark. I feel the private sector is also the biggest repository of finances globally at the moment. Private sector has got much more resources than governments, even the rich donor governments like the U.S. government, which has very generously expanding support in this area. And we have programs which have actually attempted to tap these resources, like UNITAID, for example. We are all familiar with UNITAID. It finances drug purchase primarily from taxes on international airline tickets, and the RED product, and the Corporate Champions program by the Global Fund. But I think there's a lot of room there for expansion of tapping of resources from the private sector. And we probably need to do it a little bit more aggressively and come up with more innovative mechanisms for tapping the private sector. There is also the private sector in country in terms of financing. There are a lot of community insurance programs, risk pooling mechanisms in country, a lot of which perhaps are not efficient because these are from the informal private sector. But there are some from the former private sector which are a little bit more efficient. But I think there is an effort there in the private sector to finance and to move away from out-of-pocket payments by individuals in communities. We need to give more attention on this and to refine these products and to make them more sustainable. I also feel that the private sector in countries could build national AIDS trusts, which can help finance the national AIDS response much more aggressively and in a much more sustainable manner than the resources that are coming from the outside. I'm just adding on to what Mark was saying, that the financing aspect is another area where we can probably tap the private sector more effectively than we are doing now.
Thank you, Michelle.
Just a quick word here. First, I agree with what Mark and Joy have been saying. There is an enormous reservoir of potential there that we have not been engaging enough with, or too clumsily somehow engaging with in the last few years. Second, there is also an underestimation of what the private sector is actually contributing. My concern is about another issue, and I'd like to turn to the ministers perhaps on this. It's about the private health sector. And actually, sorry to put it that way, but the private health sector is not contributing to public health. And that's a major issue in many developing countries, and particularly in the countries with a very rapidly growing economies. I really see the private health sector going its own way, not in any way contributing to a national strategy, and particularly with a national strategy to fight HTB and malaria. So how could, in your view, the private sector, health sector, be best utilized in a national plan for the common good?
Maybe when the minister is thinking, Malcolm wants to respond.
Yeah, I was particularly thinking of the situation in Asia, where the private sector represents a huge proportion of the health sector provision. And while I absolutely accept that there are difficulties, I think it's rather dangerous just to dismiss and say that they're not making any contribution. I think it could be a lot better. But I think that we have perhaps not engaged sufficiently with the private sector in the way that we might have done. I think the other area where the private sector have made some very interesting progress is in the hotel and tourism industry, which, as we know, can be closely associated with HIV and AIDS, and the Alliance has been implementing some interesting work in the Caribbean about accelerating the response from the hotel and tourism industry. And I think there's huge potential to do much, much more with transport industries. One of the stalls in the exhibition is about work with the transport and road haulage industry in South Africa. Very impressive work, and not enough is being done to engage with these industries to show them that enlightened self-interest can really help them move forward.
Thank you very much, Malcolm. You wanted to address this issue. Are you okay?
Thank you. And health services is in all countries. Private sector has very large segment, so we need to engage them. And also in implementing in particularly peripheral area, I think I'm afraid to say more than government, private sector's network is strong, like provision of a different subject, but like malaria net. Malaria net is concerned, delivery is concerned, perhaps we can best use of private sector. So I think private sector has a lot of potentiality. And WHO is traditionally, we are not
good at all with private sector. But now we are improving to our relationship with the private sectors, except tobacco industry. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Hiro. Minister.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much. I think the private sector we're trying to involve in our country, for instance, in by outsourcing services like TB services, for instance, and we give them free drugs and they do it free. Of course, they charge for additional services they provide, but they give the drugs free. And many are now involved in ART also. We give them free ART and they give it free, but they can charge for other services. And people who want confidentiality, actually, those who prefer that confidentiality is better in the private sector, they prefer to go there. But we don't deny them the free access to treatment because we give it to the private sector and they can give it. And those people who go to them can actually pay for some parts of the service. So that's another partnership we're creating with the private sector. The third, which we want to involve, I mean, which we would like to really develop in the future is we are now discussing with them, especially in addressing the human resource issue. We can use their facilities to produce more health professionals. And that addresses indirectly or directly the HIV/AIDS issue also. But the private health sector can be involved actually in many ways. Of course, they can be involved more in the urban areas than in the rural. But if they can cover as much as possible in the urban areas, then you can have better capacity to really use public services in the rural areas. So we're just trying to harmonize or align our efforts to base it on the comparative advantage of the private sector to achieve better results.
Thank you very much. Very clear. Indeed, Dostoevsky said it has been said before, but we don't want to end this session without having all the panelists the opportunity of saying those things that maybe haven't been said before, or give a comment on what they take away from this session. May I just ask a little to the table, starting with Joy, is that okay?
I'll just say what I take away. I'll take away a lot, but to be brief, I'll just say two things. The first is that one homework for the bank is to work with partners on a new form of PRSP and a new form of medium-term expenditure framework and swap mechanism, and appreciate that the current one does have a deficiency in terms of the extent to which it does not comprehensively include all stakeholders in development at country level, and that we do need to work with countries to have the model that is as comprehensive as possible, but that also has an inbuilt accountability framework so that within countries, stakeholders can hold each other accountable, and partners from outside the countries can also hold stakeholders in country and each other accountable. And that with this type of accountability framework, you should still leave space for innovation and for each partner to be able to function more effectively within the environment that they are best positioned to function, whether it's private sector, civil society, or the public sector government. So this would really have to be a very, very innovative tool, and it will need a lot of thinking outside the box. That's the first one. The second message that I take away is that of not giving up on harmonization and alignment. Each time I'm involved in a debate like this, I become more and more convinced that until we do this at country level, until we respect country systems, and until we all become faithful to the commitments that we have made, we are not going to get there. The final message I take away is, again, that of prevention. I feel we have focused, we tend to keep coming back to health systems, which is good. Please don't get me wrong. and the link between health systems and treatment and care, which is excellent. But I feel that the multisectoral response for HIV/AIDS demands a prevention agenda, which is much bigger than the response we have been giving. And I still feel we need to invest more in prevention, and that we need to get more resources that we are going to invest in prevention.
For me, there were actually these 3 points. The amount of money, the way it's being spent, and who decides on it, because that's actually where the framework is about. If we talk about the amount of money, I think it is important that we clarify also as a message from Mexico to the political leadership around the world that a lot has been done, but a lot still has to be done in order to have more funds. And it's going to be a big fight, a fight which we have discussed today what the real issues are. And in my view, it requires from all sides, developed countries, NGOs, others, private sector, a real emphasis on the MDGs related to health in an integrated manner. And that requires more money, but not just more money. The second point has been how it's being spent. I don't think we've discussed that yet in depth. And I'm sure that, and there I agree with some of the global responsibilities. I come back to the country level, but that obviously there are very many political choices to be made. We need all money. And there is all interests behind money. Let's not forget that. If it's going to be on research, on a vaccine, on prevention, on treatment, these are interests behind the choices we make. I would just agree very much with my neighbor on the right that there is a tendency for prevention to be underfunded. So I would say prevention, prevention, prevention is key. The third point is who decides on this. And I think it was an interesting clarification we had in the debate here this afternoon, that in the final analysis, it is those who suffer from AIDS or are at risk who should have the main say in this. And that it depends on the country level how that is going to be discussed, either at the level of a sovereign government, because I agree with my neighbor on this. A government is the principal responsible entity in a country for health. It doesn't say anything about the arrangements, if that's the public or the private sector which have to do certain things. And there were that is not the case. We should make clear that our activities are still geared towards campaigning against stigma and in favor of marginalized groups, because that's again the relationship between how money is distributed and who decides on it. It should not be the interests, but especially those people that are not sufficiently profiting yet, and that are those who are not yet suffering. That's the issue of prevention, but it's also those marginalized groups who are not sufficiently giving any treatment. Thank you.
I agree with what has been said, and I will start with what was suggested, which I also share, to focus on prevention, which has been said by the minister really in a good way. But in addition to that, let's institutionalize prevention, because we have said Almaty Declaration 30 years ago, but we don't have institutions to realize that dream, which also focuses on prevention into reality. So we need to institutionalize it, and that institution should actually empower the grassroots for better impact, better results. So that's what I have learned. And the other issue is, we have said lots of things today, and which is not really different from what we have been saying before. I think the saying, the writing, the design is not a problem. It's the action which is important, and just a call to really all of us to commit to realizing what we have said into action, and to commit to political tracking that can at least change whatever we have said into action. Thank you.
Thank you. I see areas of clear consensus. I see areas of concern and some areas of tension. Areas of consensus, very clear. Monterrey, Paris, those principles remain, and we all agree are to guide us. Second thing, health systems versus disease-specific is a false debate, and MDG, health-related MDGs, should be at the forefront of our common advocacy. Third area of consensus, no more out-of-pocket spending, and we heard that from all of us, including the World Bank, and more emphasis on health insurance and social protection schemes in the future. Fifth area of consensus, alignment on country priorities. And here, as Global Fund, I must say, I feel good because we are totally country-driven. So it is you, the countries, that tell us what you wish us to fund. Fifth area of consensus, a need for a focus on effectiveness through a results-oriented, a result-based perspective in aid. The area of concern is what you said, Bernd. It's resources. It is resources, major area of concern. There isn't much we can do here as we stand, or as we sit, rather, but a major area of concern that remains at the end of the debate. And the areas of tension to me is first this issue of making sure that the civil society's voice and that the civil society's capacity to implement and that of the communities is fully integrated in the government's policies, strategy, and that we really build that consensus at the country level that is needed to have all stakeholders fight the epidemic. The second area of tension I see is how much degree of exceptionalism we still need in the epidemics versus the need for integration. The third area is around harmonization. We all say we want to harmonize. How are we being and where, at which level, and how we will harmonize is, I thought we didn't really bring the answers here. What I can say is that the Global Fund, on behalf of the Global Fund, will use all of its flexibilities that you were kind enough to mention, Tedros, to contribute to the harmonization perspective. Thank you.
I think what I'll take from this debate is the fact that we are unable to answer the question of whether the current financial architecture is the correct one in terms of design and in terms of the amount of resources in it to address the current epidemic. And what I also take from here is that in order to be able to answer this question, everybody has to come to the table, especially those especially the countries, in some countries in Europe, and I suppose here in South America, in America, in South America, have to come to the table. And what I also take from here is that we need more discussions with civil society in my country, and we need to engage more on all these debates because we cannot address this epidemic if we are not together on it. Thank you.
I'd like to thank the panelists and the audience. I've really deepened my understanding and also deepened my belief that we have the right principles, we have the right numeric targets and the right financial targets. Now we have to meet our commitments. And with that, I'll follow my own recommendation.
I think that we have an opportunity in 2 years' time in Vienna to see if we've made any progress or whether we have just had a talk and we've not actually produced very much in the interim. So a key point for me is that, yes, we don't need any more meetings to discuss the principles, but we do have to, all of us on the panel and the agencies we represent and the other agencies in the auditorium, we really need to take action forward, and I think that has to be at country level. I think the second point is that there is good practice out there. There are some countries that are starting to demonstrate how this can be done and how obstacles and blockages can be overcome, and we need to do more and better about disseminating that best practice.
Two quick points from me. One, just to offer Joy, let her know that civil society will be ready to contribute to that process of deepening the PRSP processes. We're ready to engage in that. The second one was just one thing that I'm a bit frustrated not having been able to bring into this debate, is the idea that global financial architecture, which was the title, needs to work for the globe. And I'm worried that because we were discussing AIDS, the response in middle-income countries is going to be critical for the success of the AIDS response. And one of my other concerns is I do think that the global financial architecture does not work well enough for those middle-income countries, particularly in this region.
Thank you very much. I will take with me the fact that we need really to quicken the pace of action. We are 2 years from the Universal Access 2010, and I personally believe that collectively we can really push and make sure that we will reach Universal Access, which will be the only foundation to reach the Millennium Development Goals. That is the first one. And to do that, we need really certainly to have a more predictable and sustainable financing. Second things, I think we need to really improve our targeting in terms of having better targeting in terms of resource allocation. It's very important if we want to reduce the unit cost of any result we are producing today and to make our effort sustainable. And again, thanks for these panels, and I found it very interesting. Thanks.
So it's very difficult to speak at the last, but I have 3 points and another 3 points, but they're not long. The 3 points is WHO has been engaged in many disease control activities. And if you look at the success, I think I have three sort of common components. Sustainable commitment in terms of financing and political term. Second is sound technical knowledge. Third is robust strategic monitoring and evaluation. So that being successful. So in order to do so, WHO as technical agency, I think I learned 3 things from this panel. Number one, we need to be more aware about global architecture has been changed. It is not, WHO was born 60 years ago, but now modern age comes. This is number one message, my colleague. We are changing, as Dr. Chen spoke at the opening ceremony. Second, more practically, we are continuing to work with governments, and also we feel more engagement of civil society is very important, and we will do that. Third is, I'm very happy that prevention is highlighted. We will redouble our technical activities in that area. Thank you very much for calling panelists.
Well, thanks for the audience first and the panelists also to have survived a longer session. And I guess that some minutes of a session will be available on the IAS website. And I'm pretty sure that Craig McClure and the IAS will make the engagement that we'll have another session of this kind in Vienna in 2 years, only if we are able to have some evidence of progress and action. Thank you very much.